thank you, all you loyal listeners, for hanging in there. Sorry about this. We should be going into substance in just a minute. This is Free Radio. This is 96.3 FM on your radio dial. I'm Robert Norris, and we're more or less headed for 2.5 hours of the usual interviews, civil rights concerns, wild and crazy call-ins, and, of course, the endless theme song suggestions. So don't want to spend a lot of time on that today. Hopefully, we can actually come up with a working committee that can consensus on an appropriate theme for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. You can always tune in. You can always give in your suggestions if you'd like. Send in your CD discs, tapes, and we can even bring you in the studio with a guitar. I was actually thinking it would be nice to get Phil Free or Skidmark Bob to do a special kind of guest edition of some of their fine street songs here in Santa Cruz, since that's the real local stuff. That's the real deal. That's real people who are or have been earning their living on the streets at different times. Their eyes, ears, and bodies have been there while things have been happening, and they were intimately involved in what went on and what went down. So, thank you for tuning in today, and if you want to call in and be a part of this, it's pretty easy. 427-3772 is the number, and its lines are open. A couple of quick announcements before we begin an interview. I'm going to be playing a long interview with Richard Edmondson, who is the author of a new book called Rising Up, which I've mentioned before on the air. He's also the founder of San Francisco Liberation Radio, along with Free Radio Berkeley, probably the oldest radio, free radio or micro power radio station in this current wave of free radio stations. Others have been around longer in some respects, but Dunifer and his new technology, Stephen Dunifer of Free Radio Berkeley, who began manufacturing free radio kits that people could assemble quickly and cheaply, kind of ushered in this new era. That's my perception of it. And San Francisco Liberation Radio, which began and still continues in Richard Edmondson's house, is a result of his work with Food Not Bombs and the incredible harassment that that organization suffered, the hundreds and hundreds of arrests that they suffered while continuing to put out food for people. They still do so to this day. Santa Cruz chapter of Food Not Bombs, which is autonomous. This is an anarchist, that is to say, local grassroots group. Anarchist, for those who don't know, it means self-governing. It's a group that doesn't take its orders from on top. Every individual is their own master, and its decisions are arrived at by consensus, I believe, although I don't think Food Not Bombs is actually meeting much these days. I haven't heard of any scheduled meetings, but it is available as a resource to homeless people and poor people and hungry people and everybody. Saturday, I believe it meets at the town clock, and I believe it has two other feedings on two other days at San Lorenzo Park. And I may be a bit behind on that. For people who want more information, give a call to 425-3345. That's for our Santa Cruz bombs. Somebody's calling in now.
Hi, it's Free Radio.
Just to see if I heard it right. Wasn't there an issue with San Francisco bombs where if you had a ladle, if you touched a ladle, you would be arrested? But you could, they brought the food out, but they just had to leave the food there because they weren't a license-serving... a license-serving caterer?
The deal was, no, actually, they would grab people as they tried to bring the food out. It was...
Under health and safety...
Yeah,
code,
no,
right?
It wasn't even serving the food. It was even preparing it or bringing it out there. But there were times when, in order to use a different strategy, Food Not Bombs up there, had people serve themselves, and then there were other times when the servers were dragged away when people had to serve themselves, but usually the cops would take the food
and you know what's back,
at the same time.
You know what's back afterwards about that? Is that they claim it's for health and safety, for sanitation sanitation reasons, keeping that one person with the glove on their hand.
Yeah, go to dumpsters instead.
And instead, just have a bunch of people walk up and grab the lid and open it and have to serve themselves and make a mess and know, you want to have one big server, you know. Mm-hmm. Even the camps in Gulag and in the German camps had the decency to have that somebody serve the people, you know.
Plus they had bands as people marched off to the concentration camps, which is pretty good. The gas yeah. chambers. Yeah, I
people were arrested during the Russian movement to arrest a lot of people. They're for feeding people, man. It's nothing new. It's just with a different name.
Well, I'm glad that at the moment it's not happening in Santa Cruz. Though it's also true that there's no high profile feeding operation downtown anymore, like Feed the People or Food Not Bombs used to be. And I guess you know, some people feel that that's a good thing because it should really be more of a charity service, or it should be something that, you know, is low profile and actually feeds people rather than, let's say, create political capital by showing people that poverty is visible.
I hope the people that stop and keep other people from eating choke on their damn sirloin steak.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
And that was one of our regulars. Thank you for giving us your thoughts on that. Perhaps another regular calling in.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello.
Hi.
I heard you talking about Food Not Bombs. Actually, I saw them serving at the Clock Tower yesterday.
So that is, they are serving on Saturdays, huh?
Yeah.
You know what time they serve?
Well, I knew it used to be 2:30, but I was down there around 4:30 and they were serving.
Yeah, I think they also either serve one or two other days, as I was saying, at San Lorenzo Park, or they did about 8 months ago when I was working with a group called...
Yeah, I know they used to be over there, but...
group called ROAR, Restore Our American Rights of Campers. We kind of, you know, ranged our schedule around Food Not Bombs, and, you know, they show up with vegetarian food on bikes, and they're great, or they did, and I'm hoping they still do. I think Paul is a man who covers that, and again, his number is 425, or Food Not Bombs' number is 425-3345, if people want to get in touch and donate food or money, or want to volunteer, and or just want to know what's going on. If I'm not mistaken, you are the notorious Steve Argue, the man who spent seven months in jail for defending a woman and her child about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Well, how could you do such a thing? And what are you up to now, I should say?
What am I up to now?
Yeah.
Well, I do my radio show every Saturday.
At noon, noon to 3.
Yep, and I'm doing habitat restoration work for endangered species during the week. Mm-hmm.
Any reports on other activists that you want to, you know, stuff going on in San Jose or San Francisco you think people should know about, or upcoming events?
Well, San Jose, something happening over there. I don't really want to talk about it until I really know for sure what I think was going to happen. So.
Okay.
But in terms of the local sleeping ban, I was talking to a homeless man yesterday at the Food Not Bombs, and he had a suggestion he wanted relayed to city council members. Terms of suggesting, instead of, he's for completely getting rid of the sleeping ban too, but these politicians are refusing to take any action on that. He was suggesting them possibly taking up a decriminalization of sleep, making it possible for the police to make people move along who are sleeping and take up their camp. He was suggesting, like, give people a period of time to move their camp, and if they don't move their camp over, like, I don't know, he was suggesting a month, but, you know, any type of time would be relief for people, like a week or whatever, for people to move their camps and then possibly be fined. Would be a great relief for people not to have to worry about getting a fine without being warned for sleeping or camping. And
did he have any reports about attacks on camps recently or tickets?
He didn't, no.
Have you heard anything about that yourself?
I haven't. I've been living in Capitola, and I haven't been talking to as many people on the street lately. And I actually haven't heard anything, and I had heard, like, a lot of tickets had been down.
You mean there were less tickets than before?
Less tickets, but I don't know. I don't really know, because the last few months I've been off the street. I've been not around a lot of the service centers, talking to as many people. I have seen the police harassing people though, and, you know, I mean, like I called in a while back how they were sitting at this corner where a lot of homeless people cross the street to go to the homeless service center and giving people tickets there on the light at Mission and
so
River
a couple
street.
Weeks ago or
what's that?
Several weeks ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I mean I'm sure the police are still up to their old tricks, you know, and I saw them there doing that, harassing homeless people. So.
Well, I expect, of course, my 10% cut of your lawsuit on the newspaper sales stuff, which were, for the folks who don't remember, there was an incident, I guess now it's, 2.5 years ago, in front of New Leaf, the day after you and others were involved in a Stolen Lives, a John Dine Memorial event at the town clock. Police arrested you in a relatively brutal fashion for selling a street newspaper in front of New Leaf Market, although they later changed the story to different things like blocking the sidewalk, resisting arrest.
Now they're back to saying it was for selling a newspaper.
And they're claiming that the original arrest was valid in spite of a specific exemption in the municipal code that says you don't have to get a permit to sell a newspaper. Right. Actually, it's to display a newspaper, and they're claiming that display does not mean sell.
Exactly.
So it's interesting that they would say this when for the last 2 years they have allowed people to sell, not just display newspapers without bother, and now that they're being taken to court on the issue because they severely bothered you, they want to claim that that was never the case, that you were never allowed to sell papers.
Right.
And I think what we need to do is get about 10 people downtown selling papers and have them, arrest everybody or not arrest everybody, cite everybody or not cite everybody, not use one standard for one person, one standard for another, change the laws and rules around.
Right. Well, they say, see, where they're in a tight spot with that, in order for them, for the city lawyer to defend themselves, they have to claim that it was illegal because it says right in the police arrest report that I was arrested for selling newspapers. So...
Well, that's the thing we took. I took 3 times to the Citizens Police Review Board saying he was arrested for selling a street newspaper, and 2 months before, Chief Belcher had specifically written in a letter to Anthony Douglas, another street vendor, that he apologized, in essence, to him for having him arrested for having him cited for selling a street paper.
Right.
He was never actually taken into custody. And given that fact, and given, you know, what the police department then did in a whole series of internal memos back and forth was they said to the CPRB, oh no, it wasn't arresting a street newspaper, it was obstructing the sidewalk and putting your finger in the police officer's face and saying, what's my name? My name is Fuck. Although I never heard anybody else say that you said that. That was the claim they made. Made numerous claims on their whole form in their response. But the basic way that this whole thing is being manipulated is that, you know, you try to complain to the police review board about police misconduct, and they claim, he was doing other things. You take it to court to claim, okay, you claim we're doing other things, but the police report says it was selling a newspaper, what's going on here? Then they go back to the original story. And they have the legal resources to do this seemingly endlessly, and until we get people on the other side who are willing to spend either time or money to fight it, it's a difficult and lonely battle. It's kind of like a tiny voice in the wilderness. How are you feeling out there, tiny voice?
Well, I don't know. In terms of this, a lot was gained immediately afterwards in terms of the police backing off from harassing people who were selling newspapers.
And I think they still are backing off. I haven't heard of anybody else told not to sell newspapers.
Right. No.
So this is just a unique circumstance. They're trying to claim they're doing this, but they're not. They're trying to claim there's a rule against selling papers, but they aren't enforcing it against anyone else. They're just using it to defend themselves in the civil lawsuit.
Well, actually, I was, at one point, about half a year ago, I was selling a newspaper, and one of the hosts told me I couldn't do it, and said it very loudly, and he called for backup, and a whole number of police came and met him down the street, and they were getting ready to arrest me, according to a witness that was listening in on them, but then he got word not to, and that I was right, and that it wasn't illegal to sell newspapers. And he came back and very loudly said that to me, apologizing me to very, very loudly, and saying that I'm doing this so loud, this apology so loud, I'm doing it as loud as what I said before to show that you were right, you know. So there was. was one instance where they did try to stop me, but then...
I hope that becomes part of your lawsuit, that they had come to the conclusion that it was legal, and suddenly,
right.
Months later, they're going to come back with an argument that it's not. I mean...
Right. And then in terms of getting a license, a man went in, tried to get a license to sell a newspaper into the town hall, and was not given any information on how to do that, and was instead given information on when it's legal to panhandle.
I actually talked to two people who tried to do that, and I think one of them was the man you mentioned, mm-hmm. and they were told that there was no procedure for getting a permit for anything except selling food, and that was something about, you know, maybe you're allowed to sell food from these booths or under certain circumstances, and that in order to get that kind of a permit, or you had to get some sort of special dispensation from city council, if I understand correctly. So in essence, there is no process. I guess what we were asking...
Then that's a pretty deep violation of rights in terms of the fact that the corporate newspapers, the Sentinel, the Mercury News, all these other newspapers are allowed to distribute their newspapers. They've got boxes all over where they sell their newspapers right on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're discriminating against street newspapers and socialist and anarchist newspapers, alternative newspapers that don't have those boxes.
It's also a discrimination.
Clear violation of free speech.
I think it's a discrimination against homeless people because Street Spirit, the paper you were selling, you were selling several papers, but that certainly was one of the papers you were selling,
right.
is a paper that's sold by homeless people as an alternative to panhandling so they can make money and put out information about homeless civil rights struggles. And that, I think, it's not so much the content of the paper that the authorities object to, though no doubt they don't really agree with it. It's the idea of homeless people in visible places causing a blemish on the, you know, Carmelish, pure street downtown, the Pacific Avenue. That's my thought on that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the ideas in it as well, you know, that homeless people are human beings, that the police, you know, there's articles in there about police misconduct against homeless people, articles about, you know, the rights of homeless people opposing the sleeping ban and various things that the authorities don't like either. And then on top of that, there was the demonstration that had just happened the day before for Happy John Dine.
Back in 1998 in November.
Yeah, just before I got arrested. My newspaper, my picture was in the Sentinel that day on the second page, standing beside two of the newly elected city councilmen at the time, Keith Sugar and Christopher Crone.
Their last appearance against police abuse.
Right, and that was at a demonstration of about 100 people. They were there calling for a stronger review, which they've never followed up on.
Oh, quite the opposite, yeah.
And I was there calling for the firing of the entire police force and starting over, and bringing out a lot of the facts of the case, along with a lot of other activists who spoke out there. But my picture was right there in the newspaper, and I think that's part of what made me a target that day, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that for those who want Street Spirit, it is now, the new March issue is available. You can give a call to 423-HUP, 423-4833, and it's also available at the Homeless Services Center and at the community Page Smith Community House, which I'd be able to pick it up probably Monday or Tuesday. Or just look for the car with all the bumper stickers and ask me if I'm around. I'd be happy to pass on. This is a paper which people who are homeless or recently homeless are allowed to sell without cost, although I think if you get the first 10 free and after that it costs you a dime, and you get to sell them for a dollar each, so it's a pretty good rate of return for you. So, and how, you know, I expect you to be selling some papers too, Steve, for heaven's sake. Let's not say that the police have driven you from your newsy spot, man.
Oh, no, they haven't. I've sold some off and on. I haven't been selling any papers real recently, but
mm-hmm.
I think getting out various alternative newspapers, including Street Spirit, is another important medium for getting out news, like free radio.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing for people to do.
Anything else going on you think we should know about? Anything coming up?
Not for me to announce right now.
You heard about this Reclaim the Streets party coming up Saturday, March 17th, the town clock at 2 p.m.?
I have heard about it. In fact, that flyer in there was slipped to me by someone.
What is this? Any details on this? It says no more police brutality, no more homeless harassment, no more yuppie crap. Take the power back. Wear a mask. RTS. Reclaim the streets. And there's an anarchist symbol through the word party. What is this? What is this?
I know nothing about it.
You know nothing. Fine. A likely story, Steve. All right. Well, anybody who knows something, please call in immediately or contact your local police department.
Oh, no. Okay.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. Bye.
So, yeah, that week there's going to be a number of things happening, not only on Saturday the 17th, but on Monday the 19th, the California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project is having a five-hour shindig. They're going to be talking about criminalization of the poor and organizing against it at a sort of a Northern California-wide meeting. It was going to be hosted at Becky Johnson's house, but it's being moved to a wider, broader place. I think it's going to be catered so that there will be Joe Schultz slurping soup available. Some other tasty thing from India Joe Schultz, previously of India Joe's, now his own caterer. For more information on that, the event will be from 9 to 2 on March 19th. Give a call to 423-HUFF, and we can give you the exact location. It's on Nobel Street. I don't have the exact number here, but I will be announcing it at a future show, and everybody is invited, particularly those concerned with civil rights. It is an organizational meeting, and we're trying to organize. You know what they say? Even though they have slain the sleeping ban repeal movement for the moment, you don't mourn, you organize and resurrect and proceed. There's also the Monday morning group, which meets. That's previously called the Mainstream Advocates, a group involving Michael Schmidt, Joe Schultz, Ann Alper, Bonnie Moore, Lydia Blanchard, a bunch of folks. Open to the public at the Baker's Square restaurant on Ocean Street every Monday morning at 8 o'clock for all you early birds. That's tomorrow morning. Come on down if you want to see what's cooking around their efforts to get the sleeping ban in front of the community and get the community mobilized to make sure that this time council doesn't duck it. This time we get rights for people. This time, whether it be through lawsuit or initiative or a mass protest or direct action or whatever the method, and again, that remains to be determined by people who come to these meetings, that there is a change in the status of homeless people, so that no longer will you be given a $54 ticket for sleeping, when in Santa Cruz there is no legal place for the overwhelming majority of homeless people to sleep at night. And instead we have a law that criminalizes them, drives them out of town, drives them out of sight, makes it unsafe for women, as we talked about some weeks ago. Commission for Prevention of Violence Against Women has come out against that in a letter to the city to no avail. Still, the established politicians such as Marty Wormhout, Tim Fitzmaurice, our mayor, or our emperor, as I like to call him, and I've been criticized for doing, like to call this, you know, this is something that they insist on keeping in place. Although they say they're very concerned about homelessness. Oh, yeah, they want to do lots about homelessness. But in the meantime, $54 fine if you sleep at night. Here's a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, we start the fire, but the rock is burning, and we didn't start the fire. That's for V-Man.
Hey, well, listen, I think we could use you for a re-recording, kind of bring it up into the 90s. Well, we got to get some new lyrics for that tune. It's a little old and out of date, so I think we need to talk about the Santa Cruz events, and I expect you to write some new lyrics, and you and I can do a kind of a combined singing.
Well, we didn't start the fire?
Yeah, sure.
Well, what do you got? Well, I mean, what's with you in that song?
You know,
you just can't let it go no matter what. Well, you want to rewrite it.
It burns a lot of people up, it's true, you know. But I got to point out that we didn't start the fire, so.
Well, I still think Ball Confusion by Temptations would be the best of that.
Right. Well, do you have any reports from the senior side of town? I should say the trailer park city and the situation with Capitola, rent control, and life in a, well, out there.
Nah, nothing. You know, I haven't heard nothing about the, we still have rent control.
In a trailer park?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the lowest rent control in the state of California.
But we should turn the entire city into a trailer park, and we could all get rent control. That might be the one way to go.
Well, I think it'd be better off as a reservation myself.
Well, it probably already is a reservation, except that,
for the socialist capitalist, according to Mike Rockin.
Well, socialist.
Read that newspaper article?
I actually have that article in today's Sunday Sentinel about socialism and capitalism. And
okay, like how socialism and capitalism can rub weenies or something?
Well, they can at least claim to. I don't know what you've got, really. You got some strange imitations and some interesting posing going on. Well, I will take into consideration your usual pungent criticism of my theme song. Anything else you want to talk about?
I figure we can just have that song playing in the background and just chat about the weather for the next hour.
I'm going to work on that. I'll put it on since you are making a request.
Yeah, I'll dedicate to V-Man. No, I left a voicemail message last night about Bill Gates and 963 being a Bill Gates pirate radio.
I know. Notice V-Man is giving you lots of airplay in the last hour or two. I think that shows he's really sentimental for your return to the air here. He wants you back in the station, possibly with a beer or two and a little partying.
He's probably too much to think he wants to marry me or something.
Well, I don't know about that. I can't speak for his preferences there, but perhaps the V-Man will call in with some thoughts, or perhaps not, since this is a show about civil rights for poor people, not ex-radio broadcasters.
That song he played, though, I thought was better than We Didn't Start
to
Fire.
I really think that people should consider, you and others should consider starting a second radio station, because there's...
I love that.
Well, you know, then what you should do is sit down at a table or look for a grant from a group and get enough money together, and then just, it's not very much, what, $500 to $1,000 should do it. You got to pay the rent or do it in somebody's house, but then you can do a second radio station. Then you wouldn't have all these, you know, trying to wedge in a comment or two in this pathetic "We Didn't Start the Fire" scene. You know, it's really because you obviously have a passion for radio broadcasting, and you know your focus is different than Free Radio Santa Cruz.
It is a little funner than TV, I gotta say.
There you go.
I don't have to go in there with 12 people. I just gotta go in with a 12 pack.
Yeah, well, there you go, and you get some students involved. You know, I mean, I continue to wonder why the students haven't come up with a radio station. Maybe you have some Spanish language folks involved.
Well, they got their KZSC.
Well, that's not really their KZSC. That's a sort of a bureaucratic run, difficult to get into station. I mean, in some respects, it doesn't have the freedom that Free Radio Santa Cruz does. You could, you know, I mean, it's time for Free Radio Santa Cruz 2 in Santa Cruz, over time. I mean, I think that there's plenty of room.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah, like a sister station, you're right.
Definitely. Or, you know, a mother station.
Station.
I don't care, whatever you got. Let's get a station.
Well, I was talking to Skid Mark Bob, but we're going to take over KZSC on 4x4.
Oh, really?
No,
well, I won't be a part of any kind of conspiracy on the air, I'll tell you.
I don't know what Merlin's talking about. All right, man, I'm going to let you go.
All right, if you see anything interesting going on, you think that bears on civil rights for poor people, either indoors or outdoors, please call me back.
All right.
Bye-bye. But we didn't start the fire, and we are, however, on the air here, and you can be too. 427-3772 is the phone number, and it's time for you to call in and get on the air. But again, try to focus on some of these topics that we're interested in, namely basic civil rights, and issues around the sleeping ban, rent control, how people are treated by organizations as a consequence of their being poor, people, you know, in businesses, how they treat folks who are coming in. Anyway, here's an incoming call. Hi, you're on the air. Or you were on the air. Hello? Hey there, caller. Call back if you can. I'm sorry I was a little slow on the uptake. We're going to sig you shortly, as I promised half an hour ago, into the Richard Edmondson interview. And I was talking about that. Edmondson is a San Francisco Liberation founder, and he still broadcasts. He designs programs that are broadcast on other free radio stations, and he's also been a long-term supporter of Food Not Bombs. He's been arrested a number of times, as have many of us, with that organization. And Food Not Bombs is still under some attack. I mean, we were able to secure it a pretty significant safety space when I went to jail in 1996 up in San Francisco, and Food Not Bombs fed on the steps of the jail every morning. As I stayed that month in jail back there in the summer, and I think as a consequence after that for several years there were no arrests. Then they started arresting people again. I think it was either in the fall of 99 or the fall of 2000. I'm a little unsure about that at the moment, and it was around the election campaign. It must have been in the fall of 2000, and a hunger strike by Sister Bernie Galvin and others turned that back, and there haven't been any arrests that I'm aware of in San Francisco since, although Food Not Bombs in other cities has been harassed. So let's hear more. Let's actually get directly into this long-promised and now about to be delivered Richard Edmondson interview. Richard, as I said, has written a great book, which I've requested the library cover, get a hold of, I should say, and make available. It's called Rising Up. And I've done a review of this book in the current issue of Street Spirit. You can read my take on it.
just grab a street spirit downtown, fork over a buck to a homeless person, or if you're homeless or poor yourself, you can probably get a free copy or at least look at one, and check it out at the library. And here's the author of that book talking to me about a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months now. Let's check it out.
It's about 1:05 on January 28th, or is it the 27th? It's the 27th, Saturday afternoon. I'm out here on Geary Street at the secret location of San Francisco Liberation Radio, which in fact is none other than the home, catch this all you police officers, of Richard Edmondson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Robert.
And you are a man of many skills. You're sitting at your computer here in this looks like living room come radio station. You were one of the founders of San Francisco Liberation Radio. You were a stalwart for San Francisco Food Not Bombs. A man who lived in his vehicle for a number of years. You're a researcher. You're a writer. Just what aren't you, anyway?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a venture capitalist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. Kind of a jack of all trades.
And we're actually here about mid-afternoon, well, 1 o'clock or so, and in San Francisco on a kind of a sunny Saturday. And this is a station that's on the air how many hours a day?
We're on the air 7 hours a day. We go on the air each afternoon at 4 p.m., and then we're on until the 11th each night, and except on Saturday nights, we go to midnight.
And are you pretty much the man who's doing the station, or is it split with the number of people?
Well, no. I mean, we have some 30 to 40 DJs who come in here and do various programs. We also have, like, a board of directors, of which I'm only one member. There are, I think, 6 or 7 altogether. And the board makes all the, like, financial decisions involving the station. And we also have regular DJ meetings in which all the DJs get together and make decisions like, you know, well, whether or not we want to do a fundraiser or whether we want to sort of support a protest. We recently adopted a proposal to endorse a moratorium on the death penalty, and we signed, you know, that was something Equal Justice USA approached us about, and so all our DJs voted unanimously on that. It was, I'm not by any means the sole means of support of the station.
How many people are actually involved with Free Radio in terms of, well, say, starting with the number of DJs, but then just adding, if you add everybody who's involved with the station, what are those numbers look like?
Yeah, everybody that's involved with this station? We have about 30 to 40 DJs. We have, some of the programs that we have are hosted by, like, 2 or 3 DJs at one time, and then others, you know, just come in and do individual shows individually. But it's about 30 to 40.
And what percentage of your programming is in English?
Just about all of it, in fact. We used to have, and that's a shortcoming of our station, which I feel is certainly an inadequacy about our state. We used to have a program in Chinese, but the lady who was doing that quit, and we haven't been able to replace her yet, so we definitely need more programming in different languages.
Indeed, San Francisco, I mean, Santa Cruz, we of course have a Spanish language as a significant language by a number of people, but San Francisco is really a polyglot city. I mean, you have at least 4 major languages here, right? Tagalog, Spanish, Chinese, and English, right? And then there are dozens of others that are spoken by smaller groups of people.
Well, in this particular neighborhood here, Russian is widely spoken. We have a Russian Orthodox church just, you know, right down the street here, and that's kind of like made this neighborhood into sort of a hub of Russian-speaking people. But in this neighborhood, we definitely need a Chinese language program, and we definitely need a Russian language program. And
so we put out an appeal in Chinese and Russian for any, say, expatriate Santa Cruzans who wish to step forward and parla parushki, or I'm not sure how you'd say it in Chinese.
That would be great, yeah.
The station has been on the air since 1993?
Yeah, since May 1st of 1993. That was our maiden broadcast.
And indeed, you are famous for roaming the hills in your truck to, should we say, one step ahead of the, well, what you feared was the FCC and the police, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we started out in, doing totally mobile broadcasting out of my truck, and we would drive it up to places like Potrero Hill or Twin Peaks and set up the antenna and turn the transmitter on and you know, broadcast for about 2 or 3 hours and then break down and go home. And we were doing this like, to start out with just once a week, and we sort of gradually expanded to twice a week. And then about 5 or 6 months after we went on the air, the FCC tracked me down one night while I was doing one of these mobile broadcasts.
As portrayed in your recent book, Rising Up, Class Warfare in America from the Streets to the Airwaves, which hopefully will be available in the Santa Cruz Public Library soon. You give a very kind of detailed account of what happened there, and I think you've also talked about this on the air as well.
It was a kind of a strange night. I was in the back of my truck. It's a little motorhome camper type truck.
The truck that's parked in front of your home here?
Yeah, that one.
Hasn't been towed or hauled away? Huh?
No, not yet. It needs to be towed right now because it won't run. But
and you lived in this truck for a number of years.
I did, yeah.
In fact, as Rising Up documents, you were also... One of the primary reasons you got involved with this free radio movement was because you felt that what had happened to homeless people in San Francisco was simply not getting out through the mainstream media?
That's correct. I mean, people were having their their shopping carts taken, their belongings, their clothes, their sleeping bags.
Their vehicles?
Their vehicles, too, yes. There's one famous case of a man who died one night in the bushes outside of the Haight Street McDonald's after having his sleeping bag and his prescription medicine taken by the cops earlier that evening.
I remember I was across the street doing video work with Coalition on Homelessness several days before. They ticketed me for being in the park.
That's not surprising. They were doing a lot of that back then, and this gentleman died after having this sort of tragic, you know, encounter with the San Francisco police. And this is the sort of thing that was going on, and, you know, not to mention the whole outrage of arresting people for serving food to homeless people, which you well know about that. And so we decided that, you know, things that were going on back then were like the city was saying, well, Food Not Bombs just refuses to get a permit. They just refuse to apply for a permit. And the city would tell these lies, not only to the media, but they would tell them to judges, federal judges.
And get away with them.
And get away with it. There's, you know, one famous case quoted in my book with Deputy City Attorney Paula Jessen went before federal judge Andrew Schwartzer and said, Your Honor, we've tried and tried, but they just refused to get a permit. And so we felt like we, you know, one thing we wanted to do with the radio station was to focus on this whole issue of, you know, how outrageous it, not only how outrageous it is to be arresting people for serving food, but also to expose some of these lies that the city was telling.
How successful have you been? Now, I noticed this book, which you self-published after apparently getting dissed by numerous publishers whose names we shall not mention, you go into some detail about Food Not Bombs. I know I worked for a number of years doing flyers for Food Not Bombs and compiling archives. Keith McHenry, one of the main co-founder of Food Not Bombs and one of the main targets of the police around Food Not Bombs, was his computer was constantly breaking down. He was losing his archives, and we were always having trouble doing that. And I think some of the stuff is still stored down in Santa Cruz, but there was a problem getting information out to the public. Though occasionally you get a good story, one or two stories. Mostly it was this mythology, as it often is with free radio, that permits are just not being applied for by these anarchistic pirates who just want to snub their, turn their noses up and give the finger to authority, and they're all about acting in an adolescent, rebellious fashion without any substance involved. The truth, however, is quite different, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the truth was certainly a lot different between, you know, in the case of Food Not Bombs. In the case of free radio, of course, you know, the FCC has opened up these filing windows, and thousands of people have filed applications.
But not for urban areas, correct? There is no way to get a radio station in San Francisco here. Is that a correct understanding?
Under the rules that they have passed, there is no way of getting a radio station here in San Francisco. However, we have filed an application and requested a waiver on that rule. We actually have two applications pending with the FCC. But getting back to Food Not Bombs, though, I mean, there was a whole... I mean, the city was saying, oh, they just refused to apply for a permit, but the reality was that Food Not Bob's members were spending hundreds, literally hundreds of hours meeting with city officials in negotiations and putting in their time for free, while city officials, of course, were being paid for having all these meetings and so forth. So this claim made by the city that, oh, we've tried to work with Food Not Bombs and they just refused to apply for a permit, that was just an outright fabrication. And you know, again, one which, you know, we felt like we wanted to address on the radio. It was one of the reasons why we put this radio station on the air.
And one of the reasons you wrote this book, which in quite systematic detail goes into the history of the Food Not Bombs struggle to get a permit, and indeed it did get a permit for a period of time in 1990. 89 and 90, it had kind of month-to-month permits, and then, it had, then of course, the entire permit process was removed by Parks and Rec in the summer of 1990. So actually, it's still the case, as I understand it, that it is illegal. You can't get a permit to serve free food in a park. Is that still the case?
My understanding is that to serve food for groups of 25 or more, it's illegal to do that in a city park. But, I mean, they bend the rules every year when they have this, what is it, they call it Park a la Mode, and they have all these restaurants come out to the park and set up tents and serve food. So, I mean, it seems to be applied very selectively.
Similar to how, in, let's say, Santa Cruz, it's illegal to serve food except in a certified kitchen. This is the other thing that has been used statewide to go after food servers under the state codes. They have to have a certified kitchen. They went after Food Not Bombs and SWAP, Soup Without a Permit, feeders in Santa Cruz in 1989, claiming that we didn't have a certified kitchen, which is, of course, a restaurant kitchen. It's three sinks and so forth. But, of course, their own interface satellite shelter program, the city's own satellite shelter program, which every night makes food for the people that comes there, they don't have certified kitchens. And I also, they violate the city's own camping ban law because they aren't domiciles. I mean, they, of course, as you pointed out, they stretch their laws and ignore laws for themselves, but for outlaw groups, course, or for groups they disfavored groups is the way to put it. They act differently. On the other hand, Liberation Radio is sort of a haven for some disfavored groups, so I doubt you have any Nazis who broadcast on the station.
No, we don't have any Nazis.
So you exercise censorship, Richard Edmondson?
Yeah. I mean, I freely admit that we would not allow a Nazi or a KKK member to come on this.
How about a Republican?
Republican, that might be, you know, stretching it a little bit, but possibly we would have a Republican.
Libertarian?
Yeah, we've actually had libertarians on before.
Natural Rights Party.
Don't know much about them, so we've never had any of them on.
So, in fact, of course, the reason in Santa Cruz, the collective has the same philosophy. They don't want hate speech, as they put it. The number of rules that sometimes bother me about, I mean, I've had a Nazi on my show, for instance, a homeless Nazi to talk about. You know, that perspective, but you know, it's not like he's got a regular forum to push his particular point of view. But there is a way that anybody who wants to get a transmitter can, for a relatively small amount, do so, set one up, and begin broadcasting, though at the risk of potential harassment, though indeed there hasn't been too much harassment in California, except if, I guess, Free Radio Berkeley. And I guess you yourself did close down for a while after an unfavorable court decision in 1998, but theoretically, other stations have not been harassed, other than, I mean, they've been harassed by people going to the landlord and so forth, but you actually haven't had stations where SWAT teams come in, grab equipment, as has happened in Florida, and what, is in Illinois, I think, was also another place that happened.
Yeah, that's well, it happened recently in Springfield, Illinois, Austin, Texas, was, Free Radio Austin was raided by a SWAT team twice and had all their equipment taken, but no, we've not had that sort of, attack against us here. There have been a couple of cases of a couple of different radio micro stations in San Francisco whose landlords were approached by the FCC, who make some sort of comments to the landlords, and the landlords went and shut down the radio station.
Thank you.
Don't be fooled by the intro music, folks. It's Battered Spears Broadsides, March 15, 2001. 2 hours of civil rights in Santa Cruz coming at you.
One bullet for intolerance, and one bullet for the self-hating sellout Latino capulero that will never bust enough Mexicans, harass enough Chicanos, or beat the shit out of enough cholos to feel equal to his Caucasian counterparts. You see, downtown when you're brown, Officer Lopez is hunting down Chicanos like the Terminator, hoping in vain that one day he may be able to wake up and scrub the brown out of downtown, or at the very least, out of his own skin. Downtown! Downtown when you're brown, the muffled sound of injustice is drowned out by the boom, boom, boom of tricked out Impalas and cherried out many drugs, as the catcalls of oppression are heard up and down Santa Clara streets. And beautiful Latinos strut by on Saints Deep in midnight blue Buick Rivieras with gold smokes and silver crucifixes hanging from the rearview mirror. Downtown when you're brown on a Friday night, all the signs say no cruising zone, but what they really mean is no fucking Mexican zone. Because SJPD will pull you over for being downtown and brown, and for no other reason. And you will find yourself at the corner of 27th and Santa Clara in a McDonald's parking lot, surrounded by four police cruisers, while two bigs in SWAT gear search your car illegally, and a third one frisks you. And now I'm not talking about no pussy little frisk like you see in front of a club. I'm talking about a real motherfucking frisk like they do on cops, when they tell you to spread your legs, put your hands on the hood of the car, and they pat you down so good you think you're getting a hand job. And you know, if they don't find nothing on you, if they don't find nothing on you, oh shit, look out downtown, cause somewhere someone's getting arrested for being brown.
Are here in Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz, California, at 96.3 FM for the next 2 hours. As soon as I catch my breath, hang with me and let's do some civil rights talking and some maybe some walking. That would be even better than talking, wouldn't it? We're going to have special guests tonight. Veronica and Kiko, who spoke at City Council on Tuesday night at the Oral Communications Section, 7 o'clock. Some of you who are regulars may have listened to that show. Others who don't want to waste your time with City Council, and I can quite sympathize with that, may have missed it. There were a number of people who spoke about police misconduct. They weren't organized. They weren't orchestrated. They weren't dragged in by me or anybody else. They just happened to show up. And I guess we're going to pursue that subject even further on Sunday when the show returns. We do two shows a week for those of you who are new. One is Sunday from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon. The other is on Thursdays today. And every Thursday, 6 to 8 in the evening here on 96.3. Our call-in number, in case you want to reach us, and we do encourage you to call in, 427-3772. 427-3772, easy number to remember, and we'll keep trying to put it out there in case you don't remember it. If you want to reach us off air, it's 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is the headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Huff, but it's also where the producer of this show is sitting fielding calls in case you want to talk about stuff off air that you're a little bit uncomfortable talking about on the air, or you want to first kind of set the scene, or possibly you have some messages you want to pass on without being public at this particular point about them. So, before we get into our guests who are here, we may even get another guest coming up. There's another speaker from the city council meeting of last Tuesday who was concerned about police misconduct who may show up. But we at least have two folks who I think I'm really glad to see here, Kiko and Veronica. Before I introduce them, though, I'm going to play a little bit of an interview that happened this... Well, the interview happened just an hour ago, but the incident that provoked it was the, shall we say, the demolition of the statue of Christopher Columbus over in San Jose. I think that was on Thursday. A man who's admitted demolishing it, Jim Costner, local activist, went to court this morning, and he's now being defended by attorney Larry Hildes. And we had an interview with Larry. We're going to play that interview now, and then we're going to launch into live on-air discussion of police conduct in Santa Cruz. We're going to have two folks discussing their concerns about that. But first, a little bit about Jim Costner, who is currently in jail on $50,000 bail over in San Jose.
Hi, it is March 15th, about 5:10 in the afternoon, on the line with attorney Larry Hildes, also activist Larry Hildes. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Robert.
And you came all the way down from Berkeley to San Jose today to help a man named Jim Costner. Who's Jim and what's happening?
Well, Jim was arrested. Jim is a longtime activist in Santa Cruz on a variety of issues, Indian rights issues, homeless issues, and so on. Was arrested last Thursday. He decided to do some redecorating to a statue of Columbus.
Uh-huh.
He was offended that there was a statue of Columbus at San Jose City Hall, such a public building, and took a sledgehammer to it and did quite significant damage. Frankly, a couple more blows and it looks like he would have knocked the head off, along with the legs and one arm and part of a hand.
But the spirit of Columbus lives on.
Yes.
Wasn't Columbus this famous conquistador who wiped out, 1 to 3 million, he and his, I guess, his son, and I guess the man after him, in the course of 60 or 70 years, the entire population of Hispaniola was eliminated?
That is correct. Great hero.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's good if you need a depopulation expert, call in Christopher. I mean, they didn't have the atomic bomb in those days.
It's amazingly efficient for the Spanish were quite, who sent him, were quite good at genocide by that point.
Wow. And so he also, I understand, exported Native American slaves back to Europe. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And this is exactly the kind of thing we want to talk about. Apparently, they have his bail at $50,000, which is basically murder and serial rapist bail. And the DA was arguing today that it should be higher. She said that they were getting a great deal of pressure from concerned citizens who were offended by what he had done and claiming that he had done $150,000 worth of damage to the statue. Frankly, I don't think the statue was worth $150,000.
Uh-huh. Well, I understand. I read somewhere, I guess it was the Mercury News, that they're going to try to redo the statue or patch it up and move it somewhere else.
That is apparently the plan.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I went in this morning in front of Judge Stafford to try and get the bail reduced down to a reasonable level so we could get Jim out. And I announced my purpose, and the judge responded by saying, I set the bail. It's what I think it should be.
And did he give any explanation for this? I mean,
no.
Did you have cases in point to indicate that? I guess he's charged with felony vandalism and felony second-degree burglary. Are those the two charges?
That is correct. And the felony vandalism, ironically, is with a hate crime enhancement. I want to know who this group is, who this oppressed group is, who he's supposed to be directing hate to.
Well, maybe war criminals and genocidal murderers are, in a sense, an endangered group, and he is attacking the, a particular group of much maligned individuals. Although Columbus is, I guess, occasionally maligned, but usually he's revered, right?
Which is one of those bizarre things. The victors get to make the history.
Now, was this some sort of sinister... Are they alleging this was a sinister conspiracy where...
No.
He was slipped a sledgehammer and, he was... What's the...
Basically, they are saying that he's crazy and therefore dangerous.
Well, they claim he's a psychiatric case or that he's crazy but cold-blooded and...
Right, all of that. Apparently, he gave an interview to the police, which they videotaped, which we have not seen yet, and which, frankly, I had kept his mouth shut, and talked a lot about God and genocide, and they decided, because he believed so strongly in this, that he must be crazy.
Hmm.
After all, Columbus was a hero, wasn't he? Anybody who would sledgehammer a statue of Columbus must be crazy.
Well, he is one of our conquistador heroes, if you want to consider... I guess if you want to consider the Nazi pantheon, the Führer himself would be considered quite a hero.
Yes.
Within his own circle, of course.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Right.
And we're going to try and narrow the circle. We're not going to argue that Jim didn't do it. He did it. He's proud of having done it. We can't really argue necessity because Columbus is dead. Basically, what we're going to do is put Columbus on trial. And we're going to try and explain to a jury how offensive this is.
You think the judge, is your trial judge going to be the judge that sets the bail?
No, he's gone. I told him I was going to remove him from the case, and he said, I'm not going to hear it anymore anyway.
Uh-huh.
But he's gone.
So is there a chance of getting a new bail hearing before a new judge?
Monday. Monday at 1:30, we have a bail hearing. We're going to have a press conference at 1 o'clock. I dictated about half the press release to the support person. We need a packed courtroom. Anybody who can get over the hill, we need people there.
This is Monday at what time?
1:30. Monday the 19th at 1:30. We don't know what the department will be. We will be meeting out front at 1 o'clock. We'll go into Department 23, which is in the basement of the new building, and they will send us somewhere else.
And this is in San Jose. I guess I would encourage people, if you want instructions on how to get to this San Jose Courthouse, give a call to HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Larry, what penalties does Jim Costner face?
Well, he cannot be sentenced for both the burglary and the vandalism, because the vandalism is an element of the burglary. He can only be sentenced for one or the other, but potentially 3 years in prison.
And
they could try to make him pay the cost of the stupid statue.
Uh-huh. Is there much public sentiment you've talked to? I mean, do people sort of snarl and spit at you as you walk down the street, Larry, once they've learned you're taking this case? Do they shake your hand, congratulate you? I've had several people who I didn't know, really, who didn't know Jim Costner, look at this press release and say, right on, Jim. What's the reaction you've been hearing?
Well, I haven't gotten much yet. This is the first time I've appeared in the case. I will be in the Mercury News tomorrow, as presumably will Jim. They had a reporter there. I did go over to the scene of the crime.
So you say you went to the scene of the crime to catch the debris of the Columbus statue, and what did you see?
Well, there were a couple of bunches of flowers there, but I also stood there for a while and tried to hear what people were saying. Didn't hear much. A lot of people just didn't understand it or thought it was really funny. There were a couple of people who were just mortally offended.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people understood it, and that's going to be our job over the course of the time between now and the trial, and then during the trial, is to make people understand exactly why he did it and why it was appropriate.
How can people help, Jim? You suggested they show up at 1:30 on Monday. I guess it's looks like the 18th?
19th,
thank you.
Yes. That would be a very big help. Money is always helpful, especially if we're trying to get him out. If they don't reduce his bail, we have to get him out of there. It makes the whole case more difficult, and it makes his situation much more dangerous if he's in there. He's identified white supremacists in the area with him, and it would just be better all around to get him.
You mean by that white supremacists who might do him some danger?
That would be my concern, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He's in very good spirits, but he would be in a lot better spirits if we had him out. There's always, money for logistical stuff related to the suit. We're going to need witnesses. We're going to need experts who can talk about Columbus and about genocide of Native Americans. A lot of stuff like that we're going to need. The biggest thing we need initially is people to show up, though. We want to fill the courtroom.
Uh-huh.
We want it to be clear to whatever judge hears this case on Monday that he has support, because they have made it clear, both the judge and the DA made it very clear, that they are getting a lot of pressure from the Italian-American groups that put the statue up, demanding that he basically be hung.
Hmm.
And they keep demanding his bail be higher. The DA's office was threatening to demand $100,000 bail.
I see. Hang him high, hang him higher, eh?
Yes.
So, I guess, where can people send money?
I guess they can send it to, much as I always hate to do this, they can send it to my office. I don't know what the support, what the local contact information for him is at this point.
Well, why don't we give your office and hope that you will not be filching his checks?
I am honor-bound not to do that. My office address is 1840 Woolsey Street, W-O-O-L-S-E-Y, in Berkeley, 94703. Either make the checks out to him, or make them out to me and notate in the note box for Jim Costner.
C-O-S-N-E-R?
C-O-S-N-E-R, and they will go to his case. They will not go to anything else.
And if any local support persons for the Costner Defense Fund are listening...
They are saying that he's crazy and therefore dangerous.
Well, they claim that he's a psychiatric case, or that he's crazy but cold-blooded and...
Right, all of that. Apparently, he gave an interview to the police, which they videotaped, which we have not seen yet, and which, frankly, I had kept his mouth shut. In the note box for Jim Costner...
C-O-S-N-E-R?
C-O-S-N-E-R, and they will go to his case. They will not go to anything else.
And if any local support persons for the Costner Defense Fund are listening in, and you have a more local number and address,
that would be great.
Please call in and let us know. It's call-in number here at Free Radio is 427-3772. We're talking and have been talking to Larry Hildes, Berkeley attorney for Jim Costner, who... brought down the celebrated Christopher Columbus with a number of blows to the thigh and buttocks, apparently, the statue at the...
Knocked off both legs.
Knocked
one
off
arm,
both legs.
One hand.
And I think that covers the gist of it. We got a little garbled on the tape there towards the end. My apologies, folks. It's we have a crowded studio and new equipment and a... completely incompetent broadcaster, but aside from that, we're doing just great. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you want more information about the Costner case, and again, that attorney Larry Hildes is urging people to pack the courtroom on 1:30 Monday in the San Jose courthouse, you want to give a call to 423-HUFF, and we will give you the more specific address, directions to get there, or hopefully direct you in the direction to go so you can get those directions. If you have any thoughts on this subject, Columbus statue smashing, a fit subject for support by Santa Cruz activists, feel free to give a call. I'm of the mind myself, it's not anything I would recommend for me, you, or anybody else, frankly, but I would understand when it was done, why it was done, given the fact that Columbus is indeed, as the press release that I'm looking at here says, a celebrated mass murderer. And I'm going to read the first four paragraphs of this press release because I think it gives out some interesting and accurate information. Wielding a sledgehammer, justice activist James Costner smashed a life-size statue of Christopher Columbus in front of dozens of witnesses at City Hall in San Jose, California, on Thursday, March 8th. As the seven types of marble chips flew from the blows, Costner shouted, "Genocide! This man rode our backs! This man murdered us." And it's actually true that the Spaniards actually saddled and rode Arawak Indians. I mean, it's not some sort of metaphor. It's actually a literal statement according to accounts of the time. "Most Americans do not know the murderous history of Christopher Columbus. Examining primary historical sources by Bartolomeu de las Casas, the biographer of Columbus's son, Columbus made four voyages to the New World. He encountered the Arawaks, who occupied Haiti, or Hispaniola, if you look at the whole island. An early estimate of the Arawak was 1.1 million, not counting children. According to conservative estimate, over 3 million Arawaks lived on Haiti in pre-Columbian times, if you count the estimates rather than simply the smaller census. Columbus kidnapped, enslaved, and murdered the Arawak people. He ruled with severe discipline, ordering the cutting off of ears or nose as punishment for minor crimes. When the Arawaks fought back, Columbus used the excuse to wage war. On March 24, 1495, Columbus set out to conquer the Arawaks with 20 hunting dogs, horses, and guns. Columbus set upon the Arawaks, tearing them up with dogs and mowing them down with volleys of bullets and running them over with horses. Reporting back to Queen Isabella of Spain, Columbus boasted, "In the name of the Holy Trinity, we can send from here all the slaves that Brazil will hold." And in fact, the slave trade didn't begin going from Africa to America. It started going from Hispaniola back to Europe and to other parts of America via Columbus and his fellow conquistadors on Hispaniola. The Spaniards hunted Indians for sport and murdered them for dog food. Seeking gold, he enslaved the remaining Arawaks to work the mines. Those who refused had their hands cut off. What they would do is they would put a kind of a medallion around people's necks, and if you didn't have your medallion, then you were vulnerable to having your hands cut off. That was the way they dealt with it, according to the historians I've read. Conditions for the Arawak became so intolerable that as many as 100 at a time would commit suicide. Women were known to kill their newborn babies rather than have them raised in such hideous circumstances. Columbus would reward his officers with women to rape. Girls 10 to 12 were especially desired for rape. When Columbus' son took over in 1505, he continued the slaughter. Only some 12,000 remained by 1516. By 1555, not a single Arawak remained. Haiti remains one of the primary instances of genocide in human history, to be followed by more instances of genocide in Puerto Rico and Cuba. The presence of the statue prominently placed in City Hall in San Jose has been reviled by Native Americans as a sick reminder of the ruthless slaughter and conquest of indigenous people in the New World. And there's more to this press release. Sources for historical information on Columbus's genocidal policies: History of the Indies by Bartolomé de las Casas, Select Letters of Christopher Columbus, translated and edited by R.H. Major, People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn, Log of Christopher Columbus's First Voyage to America in the year 1492, as copied out in brief by Las Casas. And all these come from the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, by James W. Lowen. I think I actually read most of this in the last broadcast. But, hey, it's worth considering. Indeed, it's vandalism to destroy a statue, but perhaps it's a form of creative and positive vandalism when you destroy a statue of a mass murderer, because what kind of an example is that setting for our society, our children, those in our future? But you can comment on this, or you can comment on whatever else you'd like to comment on around civil rights issues here at Free Radio. I see the lines are beginning to light up, or the line is lighting up, since we have only one line in. 427-3772 is our number. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert Merlin.
Hey, Merlin.
That person thinks Jim Costa's a hero.
Say, you think Jim's a hero?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well,
I mean, you read all about this, what Christopher Columbus did. You know, no offense to the Italian people that built this statue and paid for the money to have it built and all that stuff.
I think Christopher Columbus is an offense to the Italian people himself.
I think he's a disgrace to the Italian people and the American people, not to mention a degradation to the Indian people.
Yeah, well, it's more like, you know, there were these times for adventurous types who would, you know, get involved in activities of this sort, but I don't think you want to, you know, celebrate them. I mean, I know that it's traditional because that's what American history books have done, but hey.
I think you ought to lose Columbus Day as a holiday.
I tend to agree with you. I usually call it Indigenous People's Slaughter Day. That's what I usually call it.
You know, I'm happy to see this thing done. Sorry to see Jim did it, because I'm a good friend of his. Sorry to see him do it, man.
Yeah, because...
I'm sorry to see him in jail. I wish Jim wouldn't have done it. I wish somebody else would have done it.
Right.
You know, but I hope all the Indian people back him up over there over the hill in Santa Cruz.
I hear you. Well, thank you. I'm going to roll on to our guests now and see what they think about all this. Anything else you want to say?
No, that's about it.
All right.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
And, hey, that, well, I mean, it's, can't get an argument from me, caller, on that one. I'd like to present, however, kind of move on to the next segment of the show, but we aren't precluding any discussion of this Columbus stuff. We have in the studio with us a couple that have experienced some rather interesting contacts with the police department and talked about it on Tuesday night in the evening session of City Council. We have Kiko and Veronica. And I guess, Kiko, you're going to sort of launch off this discussion. How are you doing tonight?
All right.
And what You were. Well, hey, what happened? Give us a. Pretend that you. No one here was at City Council. No one heard what you said to the City Council. And give it to us again.
Well, me and two friends who are in from Philly, with a rap group called War Club, they were out here doing some shows at the Week of Dragons, the Week for Political Prisoners up in Oakland, and they were down here performing a show up at UCSC. So we were taking a friend home, back to his grandma's house, so we could be there for work in the morning. But we didn't have no way of transportation, so we asked Veronica if we could use her car, and she was dead sick, so she couldn't even drive. She'd been throwing up all day, so she let us use her car and go up there. He lives on Bay Street, and we're on Blackburn, so it was just a trip up the hill. And on our way back down, after dropping our friend off, the police started following us, and we noticed that they were following us, so we were going up to a friend's house to get Veronica some medicine, and it was up by the old people's home up by... what's that street called? Pacific. And so we stopped, we parked, and then all of a sudden we were getting out of the car, and the police rolled up on us because we lost sight of them for a little bit after they had been following us.
Now, was this one squad car,
yeah.
Kiko? And how many police were involved in this?
It was two.
What happened?
So then we were rolling out the car, and then all of a sudden they shined their light on us and told us to get back in. And so when they came over, we asked them what was going on. They wouldn't say nothing. They just kept asking. They asked the driver for his license and the registration for the vehicle and all that. So after that, we were just waiting there, asking them what was going on, and they wouldn't tell us. Finally, they said that one of our taillights was out. So we were like, what? Because we knew no taillight was out. So then after we got out the car, because they said they were going to repo the car, and that we had to just grab whatever we had in our immediate possession. And
let me interrupt you for a moment. How do you know your taillights weren't out? Did you get out and check them? Or?
Yeah, because when we got out, we got all our stuff, and we were getting ready to leave. We said, let's check the taillight. And then they went in there and turned the key on, and the taillight wasn't out. There was one brake bulb of the brake light that was out, but even with one brake bulb, the brake light still lights up.
And what did they say when, you know, you brought that to their attention?
They didn't say nothing. They said the one bulb's out, and you don't have a license. It doesn't matter. The car's getting taken.
So the driver didn't have a license?
Yeah. And
did someone else in the vehicle have a license?
No, none of us had a license. We were just going to drop a friend off a couple blocks away. And so when we got out, we seen that, and my friend, he got his ticket given to him, and so the reason we got pulled over was for driving in 20 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. And we never got pulled over, though. So if we were driving 20 miles an hour, they would have pulled us over while we were doing it.
But let me ask you this. What color, what skin color were these officers?
White.
And what color are you?
Red.
And what color is, what color are you, Veronica?
Yellow brown.
This is all very colorful, but let me ask you, what's your ancestry? You're Cambodian, Veronica, and you, Kiko, are
an Arawak Indian.
And you actually are. You are. Shall we say, you're an Arawak Indian? No way. You mean you were one of the survivors who got it? What, did you swim away? What happened? So they were lying to us in this textbook. Somebody got away. I better call Columbus's great 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 grandson here.
Yeah,
perhaps I better not.
I was going to mention that after we got done with this, that don't believe the hype. We're still here and alive after 500 years.
Well, I mean, actually, I'm glad to hear that. When did all this happen? What was the date of this?
This was February 14th on Valentine's Day.
And what time of day or night did this go on?
It was like 2:30 in the morning. What time was it? One in the morning.
About 1 in the morning. And were there any witnesses? Did anybody come out of their houses? Or was this in a residential area?
This was like on the way, on halfway down to the hill up by a car dealership. And but on the top of the hill, there's the old people's home. So there was cars parked the whole way, and there's meters right there. So we parked right in front of one of the meters, and that's where it all happened. Nobody was there to see
nothing.
Now,
were you pulled over, or did you just park?
No, we had parked, and then they came up on us after the keys were out of the ignition, and the two people in the front were out of the car, or had their bodies out of the car, and
so
I was on my way out.
The police had not put on their sirens or their blinking red light?
No, they just shined a light on us.
And yet they claimed that they had the right to move your vehicle and to tow it because there was no registered or licensed driver there?
Yeah, because there was no licensed driver. But the thing is, they could have never known that if they didn't shine the light on us, because we were already parked.
And did they end up towing the vehicle?
Yeah, they towed the vehicle.
And where is the vehicle now?
Well, we got the vehicle back after we went to the police chief, and
police chief Steve Belcher.
We went to the police chief afterwards, but we got the car back. We talked to Sergeant McMahon in Internal Affairs, and I had my parents. But we should probably finish the story because this wouldn't make sense.
Okay, go ahead. Finish the story first.
So then we got we went and got Veronica because we didn't know what was. I mean, we knew what was going on, but this was like out of the blue. We were just like 2 blocks away from her house. We were just dropping a friend off, and we're gonna get something at a friend's house, and then that was it. Yeah, it was like no big deal because she was sick all day. So all we had to do was, it was like pigs pulled us over. We already were just chilling, parked. And so once the car got taken away, we went and got Veronica to see if, because she was the owner of the vehicle, she'd get it back because we knew the towing company would get there quick because it's 1 in the morning. So when we got back, the towing company just barely got there, and that's when she started to talk to the officer. I guess she could tell you about that.
Yeah, pick it up from there, Veronica. You were ill, right? You weren't in the best shape out there, right? And this was 2:30 in the morning?
Yeah. Yeah, so I got out there, and I tried to explain the whole situation to them. I offered them my ID, my registration, my insurance, and everything, and I tried to explain to them that the car is actually registered under my mother's name, and we have different last names because she's remarried, and I tried to explain the whole thing to them, and they didn't even look at my ID, and in any case, although our last names are different, everything else would have matched up, our addresses, our policy numbers, and everything. It would have been really obvious that I was a legal driver of the car, and I have a license, and there is a law that says that someone caught without a license will have the vehicle towed, but if the registered owner is not present. But I am the registered owner, and I do have a license, and I'm a legal driver of the car, so there was no reason for the car to be towed. And so we tried to reason with her. I tried to reason with her numerous times calmly, and she was unwilling to listen, so I asked her if I could get my books out of the trunk because I had school the next day. I go to school at the university, and She said no, that I couldn't touch my car, and I said that was fine, that she could get it out for me, and she refused to, and I said, okay, well, can you at least turn my headlights off? Because the car was being towed, it was already on the thing, it didn't need to be driven anywhere, there was no reason for the lights to be on, and I told her if you didn't turn the lights off, the batteries would die, and she said she refused to, and I said, well, can you please roll my windows up, because my windows were completely rolled down, and it had been raining, if you will remember, that whole week, so if it had rained, my car would have been drenched, and I asked her very calmly and politely, and it wasn't like she told me I couldn't touch the car. I said, that's fine, can you please do it for me, and she refused to, so
I interrupt you for a moment. Who was the officer you were, who was this woman?
She was, the officer's name were Benny and Klein, badge 181 and 189. And I don't know which one she is, but she was either Benny or Klein.
They were both female officers?
No, it was a woman and a man.
Uh-huh. So one was Officer Benny and one was Officer Benny and one was Officer Klein?
Right.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. So you said that you attempted to get her to roll up the windows because it was likely to rain or had rained, and what happened then?
And she said no. So I reached for the car door to do it myself, and she got up on me, and I said, don't touch me. And she got up on me again, and I pushed her up, and I said, don't touch me. And the two men who were with me said, get your hands off her, and she reached for her gun. And she called, like, 4 or 5 backup cars. Do you remember how many?
Total, like, once they got there, there was, like, 6, 7 cars there, just, like, just for nothing, for 3 people.
And what about her fellow officer? Was one of the officers more hot dog than the other, so to speak?
The woman was. The other officer, he was playing, like, a little bitch in the back.
Meaning
he was just, like, he was scared. He was scared of us, and he had the gun. Like we were going to do something, but we were sitting there calm the whole time. He was just scared of the whole situation.
And again, how many of you were there?
At that time, there was 3, because we went and got her, and then one of the guys stayed. So it was just like 2, 3 of us that went back.
So there were 3 men and 1
no,
woman?
No, 2 men and 1 woman.
2 men and 1 woman, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, so then, let me follow this exactly. So you trying to close your window, Veronica, were told not to do so by the officer. Actually, did she physically, this was the woman who physically sort of interposed herself, or?
Yeah, she physically got in my way and kind of grabbed me, like, by my upper torso.
Uh-huh.
Like my arm.
Was she bigger
shoulders.
Than you or shorter, taller than you?
She's maybe a little bit taller than me.
She's way bigger.
Oh, she was, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Well, she didn't seem that big
you.
To me.
And what did she say to you as you were doing this? Or did you remember what she said? Did she say anything?
She didn't say anything. I don't remember her saying anything. She just pushed. She just got up on me.
And so then the two men rose to your defense?
No. They were actually, like, really far from me, maybe 7 to 8 feet mm-hmm. at least, and all they said was get your hands off her. I mean, I was handling myself fine.
Defense.
I just pushed her off me twice, and all they said was get your hands off her.
So she then pulled her gun?
No.
She reached for it.
I backed up
as soon as I saw that, so she didn't actually pull it.
She made a motion toward her gun. She didn't actually... Did she touch her gun?
Yeah, she was ready to pull it, and I stepped back.
And then what happened?
And then, so at that point, I mean, we were all unarmed, and they had been frisked already, too, when they were first stopped by the cars, mm-hmm. I mean, by the cops, so...
By the two officers
right.
initially?
So it was already known that nobody was armed or anything, and, you know, I mean, we were completely outnumbered with 7 police cars
now before
there.
Before that, how long did it take seven police cars, you say? You counted
right,
7
it?
Cars? Or?
Didn't
I don't know,
you say
there was, like, between 5 and 7.
Between 5 and 7, I don't remember exactly.
So there were at least 5 police cars? Is that accurate?
Right, because they called backup, so they weren't all there at the same time.
So the woman, let me get the sequence. The female officer called, said she, what did she say exactly? Get me backup or something like that?
She just, like, put some kind of code into her little mic thing, and then all of a sudden, like the things were just winding down. The car was getting towed away, then all of a sudden, like, 5 cars show up. And
how quickly
just
did it
out.
Take those cars to arrive?
Oh, we were, like, more than the block away from the station, so it wasn't, like, even one minute.
The Santa Cruz Police Station.
Yeah.
Station.
Yeah.
Okay, so the cars arrived. Did they block the street?
Well, they just came in, like, on all angles. It was like, it's just like a one-way street.
Okay, and how many police officers would you estimate were there?
Well, there was like one in a car,
so about
five to seven
police officers.
Yeah, 4 or 5 more cars showed up.
4 or 5 more cars.
Yeah.
So 4 to 5 more police officers showed up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what did these police officers do?
They just came out and just all of them got out of the cars, like, walking around, like, I don't know, just kind of lollygagging, like, assessing the situation type.
Did anyone pull a gun?
No.
Well, we pretty much left once they got there, too. We didn't stay long.
Yeah, because the car was being towed. The car was, like, the tow truck was gone. And so it was, like, we were there with, like, 6 cop cars. We weren't even trying to stay around.
So soon after these cops, the last police officers pulled up, you took off.
Yeah, we just seen them all come in, and we were like, what the fuck is this? We were like, we're gone.
Now, did they try to stop you, or did they try to speak to you?
No. No, they were... Well, I don't know.
They didn't care who I was. They didn't even want to know whose car it was. I mean, they wouldn't have known who to give the car back to. You know, they were completely uninterested in who we are. They just took our car.
Did you ask for the names and badge numbers of the police officers who stopped you?
Yeah.
And did they give them to you?
Yeah, that's how we got them.
And did you get any explanation as to why they were taking your vehicle, even though you were the registered, or your mother was the registered owner, is
right.
that right? Why did they say because you weren't the registered owner, that was why they were taking the vehicle? Or?
No, they said that the information was completely irrelevant. They wouldn't even listen. They wouldn't look at my ID, insurance, or anything.
They wouldn't have known she was the registered owner or not, because they didn't give her the time of day.
Why do you feel they took this attitude? Do you think it had to do with an attitude of racial prejudice? Had they been drinking? Did they get up on the wrong side of bed?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is racial prejudice. The whole police force is racial prejudice, but I mean, so that's the whole reason they pulled us over. So from the get, I mean, it was done on racial prejudice.
And even the ticket that they gave to the driver, he gave them his ID so that they could write the ticket. And if you look on his ID, it says, on the ticket, under race, it says black. And then on his ID, it says Indian, Native American Indian. And so it's obvious all they saw was a black man in a car that was turned off. Mm-hmm. And so they towed his car.
Then this case had further consequences. What happened in the days ahead? In the days that followed, I should say.
Well, the next morning we called internal affairs or something like that. And we ended up speaking to Sergeant McMahon. We called different departments of the police. And I had my parents fax in a letter to the police station explaining that I was a legal driver of the car and that I am their daughter, and to release the car to me. And so after talking to hundreds and hundreds of people, we were able to get a trial in 3 days. And we had to pay $85 for the trial and then $130 just for them to even decide whether to release the car or not.
Hundreds and hundreds of people, or maybe 5 or 10 people?
Maybe 5.
Maybe 5 people. Felt like hundreds and hundreds of people.
I was just being, yeah.
Right, I mean.
I was exaggerating.
And so you had to pay $85 to get your car back. What, were you found guilty of anything at this trial? Were you yourself accused?
No, they wouldn't let me talk about anything that happened. The officer who did my hearing, all he wanted to talk about was whether I was really the owner of the car, if I was a legal registered driver of the car. Mm-hmm.
Was
that was
registered
it.
Driver or registered owner? Or both.
Or legal registered. Yeah, both. Basically, if I was a legal driver of the car, if it could be released to me, because I'm not actually the registered owner, my parents are.
So he determined that you were and it could be released to you?
Yeah.
But what about the fine? What about the cost?
He didn't even want to talk about it at all. I couldn't talk about anything. I did, but he wasn't listening.
Have you filed a claim with the city for the money that you lost in this incident?
Yes.
And have you talked to an attorney yet?
No, but I did get a number of one today.
You brought this case to city council. You got your car back, what, after you didn't have it for 3 days. What did you do during that three-day period? Walk, hitchhike, take the bus, rent a car? What happened?
I was real ill, too, so it was...
Quite a hardship?
Yeah. I mean, It's not really... 3 days without a car isn't that bad, but I'm just saying that... That's not the point, really. The point is that it was a case of racial profiling. We were, you know, unjustly harassed by the police and had to pay $440 to be fucked with, basically.
Did you file a complaint with our Pufferoni Police Pal Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, or they call themselves the CPRB, the Citizens Police Review Board?
No, because we heard basically they have no power.
Although it's often good to do that, even though they don't have power, simply to make a record of what's happening. And I can show you how to do that afterward if you'd like, if you're up for that. This happened on the 14th, and you came to city council, I guess it was 2 days ago, on March, what, 12th? It took a while for you to decide to go to city council. Why did you decide to go and speak at city council?
Well, we had been trying to get our money back. I'd spoke with Sergeant McMahon, the police chief, the mayor, the vice mayor, and another city council member.
Christopher Crone, Ed
Porter. Yeah, I actually called all of them, and I spoke with a few of them. Chris Crone returned a phone call, but I never spoke with him. I spoke with Pat.
And what did the mayor, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, say to you?
He was kind of like, oh, racial profiling, that's bad. But we went in there, both of us went in there requesting that if he would meet with us and the police chief to discuss the whole thing. And
did he agree to do that?
No.
What did he say to you when you requested that?
He said, oh, well, I'll try and call him and I'll have to look at the police report. And all he really ended up doing was having the police chief call me.
And that was Police Chief Steve Belcher?
Yep.
And how long after this whole incident did Belcher call you?
Just a few days. It might have been even the next day after he spoke with Tim, though. That wasn't after the incident.
Okay. And how quickly did Tim move on this to get the... Do you think did he initiate the police chief's calling you, or did your...
Yeah, he did. That he's the one who gave him my number.
And what... you didn't call the police chief directly yourself?
I had been trying to get a hold of him, but I wasn't able to, so...
But did you leave a message with the police department that you were looking for him?
Yeah.
So he might have called. Do you think he called because did he say, mayor asked me to call
you?
Yeah. And what was how long did your conversation go with the police
chief?
It was
just a few minutes. He basically, he tried to act like he was concerned and wanted to know my side and really actually ended up cutting me off numerous times and telling me to calm down when I was never excited in the first place. And all he said was, you know, I'll look into it. And I'm not sure if he ever did any kind of formal investigation.
What was the date of the call you had to him, more or less? A week ago, 2 weeks ago?
Maybe 2 to 3 weeks ago.
And have you heard back from him since?
Yeah, probably a week ago I spoke with him.
This is, he called you a second time?
Yeah, he's called me a couple times.
And what was the nature of the second call?
Basically that he feels that the towing was just and that everything that happened should have happened.
And what was your response when you heard this?
Well, I asked him what kind of investigation he did because none of us were included in the investigation.
No one had come and asked you questions or any of the people in the vehicle?
Nope.
Had they talked to your mom?
Nope.
And what did he say when you asked him that question?
Well, he said, I don't remember exactly what he said, but something to the degree that, you know, we did an investigation and we found that the towing, well, you know.
Case
he
closed.
He spoke with officers and basically he feels that their reason for towing the car was right.
And did you have any further communication with him after this conversation?
No.
So in essence, is it fair to say, I'm wondering, did you wait until you'd gotten this, had this conversation with the police chief before you took the issue back in front of city council? Was that
No, because we weren't, I mean, during this whole time, we've been trying to figure out the whole process that you would have to go through to get your money back. Because really, again, there are two issues. One is that we need our money back, and two, that the first part where you know, obviously the men were stopped because they're men of color.
Did you get your money back? I assume not.
No. That's why, I mean, we didn't feel, you know, we wanted to take other routes before having to, like, go on television humiliating the whole city council, which we never really had a chance to do, but...
Well, then you did go on television, right. vicious scoundrels that you are and troublemakers, and you talked to the city council. What kind of a reaction did you get from the council?
I don't know. Well, most of them, I think, already knew about it. I think all of them already know about it because we talked to, what's the dude's name? Big dude? No.
Oh,
Scott Kennedy.
And what did Kennedy say to you?
He was kind of more or less just like, yeah, we'll probably be able to get you that back.